Welcome to this episode of Anaesthesia on Air. This is a podcast from the Heritage and Archives Committee of the Royal College of Anaesthetists. And in this series, we are looking at the heritage of the Royal College and also at the history of anaesthesia. My name is Anna Maria Rollin, and I'm a retired consultant anaesthetist. I'm delighted to be joined in this episode by Professor Pierre Foy and Professor Helen Higham. Pierre has had an extraordinary and very distinguished career and nearly 50 years of association with this college, and I think a 66-year association with British Anaesthesia. He has also had a very long professional relationship with Helen, and I will ask them to introduce themselves. Pierre, perhaps you could start.
Thank you very much, Anna Maria. I'm delighted to be here. My career started in Switzerland because I'm from Geneva, and as was usual, I went to school and university in Geneva, and then after qualifying in 1960, started my clinical training, and it was in medicine. And over 9 years, I covered a lot of what we call internal medicine, plus a bit more than others of neurology, which was part of medicine at the time, and a lot more intensive care. So that led me to think intensive care, I'm not going to use cooking recipes for the rest of my life. I'm going to need to do some research, and therefore I need some research training, which was a logical consequence. And there were two obvious possibilities for 1 year abroad, not in the States, and that was Oxford and Hammersmith, the Royal Postgraduate Medical School. So which one should I go for? What was interesting is, as responsible for the medical intensive care unit, I had decided in 1968 to devote one bay to patients with cardiac problems needing ECG monitoring. So that was very good, very nice, and the professor of cardiology got extremely interested. I didn't ask him any opinion, I just got this going. He was so pleased that he invited us to a garden party with a visitor, Professor Lionel Opie. So we met, we talked about research, and it so happened that Lionel Opie had been a research fellow in the Nuffield Department of Anesthetics on Applied Respiratory Physiology. And he also had worked at Hammersmith in the Royal Postgraduate Medical School. And he said, look, you have no difficulty. Go to London and you will be one of 100 beginners in research. Go to Oxford and there will be only one, two or three of you and they will look after very well. So this is what happened. And that's why in January 1970, I came to Oxford as a researcher. Then I was appointed to a lectureship, to a readership, but as I'm rather slow, it took me between 1970 to 1991 to become the Nuffield Professor of Anesthetics. So that slow going, but still I got where I wanted to be, and I decided, why not to stay? Now I have the chair, I think I will enjoy the work, and I did. And then, of course, at some point you have to retire. And I thought, what am I to do with my life? In fact, there wasn't much difficulty because I loved teaching. And as I was not going to be replaced quickly, I continued to teach. What I didn't know is 22 years later, I would still be teaching medical students, trainees, and organizing meetings at the college. But we'll come back to that later. Now you know who I am. It's my pleasure to introduce Helen Higham. And I was fortunate that the head of her department contacted me in 1998 and suggested that she might like to come to Oxford to do research within my group. And this is fortunately what happened. So, Helen.
Thanks, Pierre. Yes, that's a bit like the story. I think George Hall has a lot to answer for. He was professor at George's at the time, and that's where I'd been doing my registrar rotation, as I think you're alluding to. And I think his mentorship, which was incredibly important at that time, led to exactly this, the fellowship in Oxford, and never looked back, never regretted it. But it was amusing. The point at which George said to me, I think you should ring Pierre and find out what he wants you to do, and you know, go over and see him and see what the department's like, find out what the work would be like and see if it really does interest you. And so I'm thinking, that's interesting. And this is at a point when I had not long finished my own FRCA. I was one of those candidates that was terrified that when they got to the top of those stairs, they might see Professor Foire examining them. Scary but fair, I think, is the way we would have described you. But the idea of ringing him and saying, you know, this is who I am and I'm thinking of coming over to do some research, do you have a role for me, was interesting. But I did. I rang Avril, his secretary, actually, and she said, oh, he's here. I'll just hand you over. So she hands me over and he says, oh, yes, have you been to Oxford before? I said, no. Not, I mean, I've visited, but not, I don't know it. And he said, I'll pick you up from the station. The traffic's awful in Oxford. And I thought, I work in Tooting. I think the traffic might be a bit worse in Tooting. But anyway, that was very kind. And you did indeed pick me up from the station and drop me off after I had a lengthy conversation about the opportunities. And it was clear that that was going to be the right thing for me. So that was my kind of introduction to a life in anaesthetics in Oxford. And as I say, I've never looked back. Very grateful.
I think you were one of the best appointments I've made. That has
I think
been
you have
proven.
To say that.
It was a great success, so I'm glad.
One of the core reasons for your success, Pierre, is that family feel that you always managed to culture within the group. I was in London, I didn't know anyone in Oxford, and I was commuting initially. And that very first meeting with you, and I'm thinking, I'm sitting next to Professor Foire, I'm quite anxious. But actually, it wasn't like that at all. It was super relaxed. You were just pure enthusiasm about the research, and that was exciting. But more than that, I then ended up staying with Pierre and Annelise. They had an annex on the house, and so I would stay there on occasion if I had patients to see early the following morning. So it became very much a home from home, very much like having a second mum and dad in Oxford. It was great fun.
Yeah, and Bernard and Michel, our sons, remember that, seeing interesting people which they would never have seen without being in the chair or as reader and bringing people home, which I thought was a natural thing to do. We like to do it and entertain totally informally. It was organized at 6 o'clock in the evening, let's face it.
When we were talking about doing this, we were discussing the sorts of things that it might be interesting for people to hear. And I think if you could expand a bit on the research journey.
I was interested in perioperative medicine before the word was invented, because as a senior equivalent of senior registrar in medicine, I often saw surgical patients. They were asking my opinion as a physician on the fitness for anesthesia. I knew nothing about anesthesia at the time, but never mind. I knew something, that surgery was quite stressful. So that was something I'd been interested in, particularly the cardiac aspect in hypertension. And I was the first in Geneva to make the diagnosis of Kahn syndrome. The endocrinologist never forgave me to have made the diagnosis before them and thought I should go somewhere else, like Oxford would be a good idea.
Yes, it's far enough away.
Far enough away. And having done that, when I came to Oxford, I was very lucky. I was due to do research on tetanus in the respiration unit. But there were no cases, and the team had almost disintegrated. But fortunately for me, Cedric Pritz-Roberts, who was the reader at the time, decided that he should ask me to join his group doing studies in hypertensive patients. At the time, the received wisdom was, if patients have hypertension, you jolly well stop their treatment before surgery. Cedric wasn't in agreement with that. I wasn't in agreement with that. So I joined ongoing studies, and we were able to demonstrate that, if anything, being on treatment made the patient somewhat more stable and not more unstable. And what was regarded as complete heresy is that we tested that anesthetized patient and beta blockade were compatible. That was deemed impossible. You had to stop beta blockers 2 weeks before surgery. And no, we didn't. We pre-treated with beta blockers. And what happened? what was expected. The surges of blood pressure with laryngoscopy and intubation was no longer seen if they were beta blocked, and the arrhythmias and other signs of myocardial ischemia, which were quite common in hypertensive patients. And you have to realize that we talk about early 1970s, and it was par for the course for patients to come to surgery with blood pressure of 220 over 120. That was nothing to worry about. It was a fact of life. But you can easily imagine that this fact of life meant they were, let's say, unstable during anesthesia and surgery and could have complications. So that was a natural extension to do this work with Cedric. And I was fortunate that we worked together. Things Cedric was worried about. Everybody saw that when you gave halothane and people became hypotensive, it was because of venodilation. And of course, the veins appear when you receive halothane. So it seemed logical. He decided that studies should be done. And these studies shown that it wasn't vasodilatation, it was a drop of cardiac output because halothane had a negative effect on cardiac contractility. So we did a number of studies, and later we went into cellular physiology to look at the mechanism, and with Derek Terra in pharmacology, we showed that it was changes in calcium channels within the cardiac cells that were responsible for the changes in contraction. Helen was reminding me of the trainees. You could discuss when giving anesthetics, you gave anesthetic agents, the pressure changed. You could have explanation for what was happening. And it was facilitated for me because of the research I was doing. I was very interested in cardiac mechanics, particularly in ischemic heart disease, induced experimentally. And we were looking at the way in which the heart starts to miswork when there is regional ischemia. So that really seemed quite naturally to extend from the lab to the list we were doing.
I was a trainee around the time you were describing, and reading some of the stuff which you produced, senior consultants were, as you undoubtedly discovered, a little resistant. And it was always very nice when they didn't come to the list, because then you could do what you are suggesting, and life was so much more tranquil with patients treated the way you recommended. No help, anesthesia.
As he always used to say.
And so almost immediately you changed practice. Yes,
I must admit that this is really due to Cedric Price-Roberts. He really led a small group very, very well, had good ideas, and was really superb in doing clinical studies. And we enjoyed working together for the 6 years. He was the reader. Almost the minute I had finished my higher degree, had had my viva, all that was accepted, Cedric went for 1 year to the US. So suddenly, from being his research supervisee, I was a supervisor of two day field students that had started in the lab and had to take over. After he came back, he went away to Bristol. So suddenly, by default, I was head of the cardiovascular research in the Nuffield Department of Anesthetics, which was quite unbelievable.
Speaking earlier about the way you built the team.
Yeah, the team continued to develop. I think what's interesting for me is to have research fellows both in the lab doing a higher degree and clinicians. And this is something I have to mention, and I'm pleased to mention. I was very lucky when Keith Sykes became the professor that he has appointed John Sear as a reader to take my readership that was becoming vacant. And he was bringing to Oxford a great deal of interest in pharmacology, pharmacodynamics, pharmacokinetics. And having done studies in this field, he was very well known and very competent. But he also was very interested in clinical studies. So we continued to do studies in hypertensive patients. And we started to do, with support from British Heart Foundation, on silent myocardial ischemia. So we are doing work in the lab on the dynamics of ischemia in the intact heart, regional dysfunction. But we were doing studies in patients looking at myocardial ischemia, and you were involved in these studies. And in fact, it was less rewarding than we expected, because yes, we saw a lot of ischemia, But did it make much a difference on outcome? And the answer was essentially zero.
I think the thing I was really hoping was that it might help us predict risk.
Yeah, and it didn't really predict.
Not at all.
But this is where the days cardiac biomarkers were introduced. And you
did some studies with troponins. Yeah.
And of course, this is what really gave a handle on prognosis.
Yeah.
It's the biomarkers, be troponins or NT-proBNP for heart failure. And these are associated with outcomes. There's no question about that. So we stopped doing silent ischemia by recording electrocardiogram 24 hours a day. But when we were doing that, we had some interesting observations in patients on this monitoring, because another researcher from Keith Sykes' group joined us, and he was interested in saturation. So we were recording saturation 24 hours a day. And let's face it, after major surgery, particularly the abdominal aorta and abdominal surgery, there were, during the night, dips in oxygenation that were as if you had your intensive care unit up in the Andes at 6,000 meters, which is not really the you want to have them. And that was documented evidence there of changes. And of course, that was always because they had removed their oxygen mask. And if you didn't measure saturation, you wouldn't know how bad it was. If you start measuring it, you see, I'm not comfortable with 75% saturation.
But again, if I can just take it back down to the work face, if you like, the coal face, what is now obvious, of course you have to keep oxygen on overnight. Again, your group changed practice because that was unknown before you showed it. And now it's, well, of course we know that. It has become self-evident, but it wasn't.
It wasn't self. That was interesting evolution of looking at ischemia, electrocardiogram, troponins, and looking at changes in saturation. We didn't think they would be that great. We thought, it will help us. But we suddenly realized that after major abdominal surgery, if you removed your mask, that was really bad news. And often the ECG changed at the same time, of course, when they had the lowest saturation, their ECG ST segment started to change. So it was really immensely interesting to do these studies. We applied for fellowship, for medical research, studentship, fellowships. We did quite a lot. And there was considerable support by the then Nuffield professor of anesthetics, Alex Compton-Smith. He was as supportive as you can possibly have. Every time we were doing something or presenting at meetings, he would say, fantastic, you do that. It was always support 110%. And that plays a very important role in your career when you are starting and you are not sure that you are going to get anywhere. But he was there to say, yep, that's great, fantastic. And I also had support from his predecessor, the first Nuffield professor of anesthetics, Sir Robert McIntosh, because he retired in 67 before I came to Oxford. But in those days, there were no electronic facilities of any description. So he was in the library reading the latest anesthetic journals because he was giving an eponymous lecture somewhere in Canada or in France or wherever. And we had lots of opportunities for discussion. And he was interested in what I was doing. He knew I was a rather odd person who was in anesthetics but had trained as a physician. But I must admit that at times I dreaded his questions because I knew full well that if he hadn't worked it out, unless it was really my sphere of interest, it would be very difficult to find a satisfactory answer. I was fortunate that he was coming to departmental meetings, so we had plenty of opportunities to discuss. And to this extent, when I was elected to the chair in 1991, I asked his widow, he had died a year before, to come. We had a little dinner party with Alex Compton-Smith and Keith Sykes, the third Nuffield professor. He would have been very pleased to see that I had been appointed because he had been so supportive. That was quite extraordinary on his part.
That vital role of mentorship, I think, is something we've talked quite a bit about, haven't we? And I think, especially where academic anesthesia is concerned, we're not as visible in that realm as I think we should be. But we certainly have been in Oxford, and if we run through the different Nuffield chairs, all of them hugely influential in anesthesia, both clinically and academically. And then certainly more recently for me, you were in post when I arrived, obviously. When you retired, Henry McQuay took over, and Henry McQuay was the same for me. So at the time, I was doing pain medicine, and Henry was super supportive of that clinical practice, but also encouraging more academic work. And of course, Irene Tracy, the first female holder of the Nuffield chair.
Yeah, but I support entirely what Ellen said about trainees, their quality and what you learn from them, as well as being mentoring and helping them to do the research. You learn a lot, and the diversity is something I've had in my group as well. The vast majority were anesthetists at the sort of registrar level or senior registrar, or even having completed their training. But there were also cardiologists working in my group, and they evolved, and two of them became professors of cardiology, which is rather unusual to do a day fill in a department of anesthetics and become professor of cardiology somewhere. One in South Africa, now he's in the States, and one in Switzerland, in Zurich. It was so valuable to have diverse people from diverse nationalities, diverse continents, and diverse training working in the department and working together. So it's always said that is by giving lectures you learn a lot, because if you are lecturing, you need to be up to date. You have to think about it, and often it makes you think slightly differently. They have maybe slightly different point of view. So this has been precious. And of course, when you have a lot of higher degree students, it generates a lot of work, but it also generates an awful lot of satisfaction.
I think that's so true. It's very much a two-way street, isn't it?
You know, yes, it is.
The people coming in, younger people especially sometimes, with very fresh ideas, it's incredibly rewarding.
But there is a slight downside to it, is when later in life they have all gone back to their country of origin and do a lot of work, you start to have write dozens and dozens of references for those who have trained with you, worked with you, and are now arriving at the top in their own department of country. Involvement with the college was interesting. It started in 1976 when I was asked to lecture on the final FRCA course held at the college twice a year for 3 weeks. So I was asked to lecture on cardiac risk and also cardiovascular measurement. I did that for many years. During the 3 weeks, the delegates, the trainees, had 2 weeks with tutorials. And they were all given by Londoners. And I thought, why? We could contribute to that. So I said to the college, I would be happy to do it, but I cannot do it for 2 weeks, it's too much. So with a colleague, Valerie Goat, who was much interested as clinical tutor in teaching, we decided we take each 1 week. And I did that for I don't know how many years, but quite a long time. And I stopped doing the final FRCA course in 2016, 40 years after I had started. And I did all of the courses bar one over those 40 years. And I enjoyed it. And of course, what it meant is to come to the college and interact with colleagues working at the college, members of council, and the staff running events. And it was absolutely fantastic support, and I enjoyed it so much that there was no reason of stopping doing these things when people you work with are people you enjoy meeting. So it continued quite naturally, and that was teaching at the college. I had this idea of a symposium entitled Cardiac Disease and Anesthesia, because as simple as that, no matter what list you do, you could have patients with cardiac disease. Now, if you talk about cataract operation, cardiac disease may not matter all that much, but anything else, you could run into problems. So I thought it might be successful, and it was. So we were doing it initially every second year for 2 days, and I was lucky to be able to enlist a number of cardiologists. And that's been always the case. I don't know how many. They are pretty unique to have an opportunity to listen to cardiologists.
And there's always a big buzz at the coffee breaks and at lunch. You know, people are talking about what they've been hearing, and the speakers are all mixed in. That's what's great about coming to college meetings, if you come in person, is that you can have a chat with someone that's an expert in so-and-so.
Yeah, Helen said something about your being a feared examiner. Fair, I think, was her expression.
I'm totally stunned. because I was considered a dove among the examiners. For 8 years, I served as examiner for the part two, physiology, pharmacology. And while I was doing it, the college decided that a three-part exam was unique amongst colleges. No other college has three exams. And we should change and revert to a scheme where there would be a primary, the new primary, and final. And it needed quite a bit of reorganizing, like a book of questions, so that it wouldn't be to the examiners to decide what questions they would ask, just seeing a candidate say, oh, this one I will ask about serum rhubarb. Oh, no, that serum rhubarb may be a bit too esoteric. But it was almost like that. Anything could go. So we had to establish a book of questions, and then we started to run the exam, and I was asked to take new primary examiner as opposed to part two examiner, because the part two was becoming smaller and smaller. There were still some trainees who had done old primary part two and were going final. So I enjoyed that. I found it very tiring. While examining for part two, I could examine all day running vivas and do some academic work in the evening. Once it was the new primary with OSCE all morning and vivas in the afternoon, that was that. By the time I went back to my hotel, I was totally, utterly zapped. But it was an interesting experience to have served in two exams, and that was good. Examining is one thing, but people who are examined have to learn. So I've been interested and active in teaching since, I think, 1964 as a registrar in medicine. I started to teach the medical students in Oxford, and I enjoy doing it. It's really very interesting to have a small group and be able to discuss questions that are relevant to their training.
But he's being very modest here, can I just say, because he routinely is awarded best teacher of all of the Nuffield department. The students love him, our trainees love him, and not just because he's a great teacher, because he's passionate about it and because he cares about them, you know, and that comes across. It's hugely important.
I'm so pleased to hear that.
Hugely important, and the fact that you still do it is also amazing, and more than that, that you spend a huge amount of your own time, and this was even before you retired, thinking about our international medical graduates. So we have many hospitals do, a lot of wonderful international graduates coming over, either to take up jobs in the NHS or to do fellowships, for example, many of them wanting to complete their FRCA. And Pierre spends a huge amount of time getting them through, helping them to understand the culture of the way we do exams in this country and so on. It's a huge step. And he's always gone that additional mile.
Yes, I still have somewhere a folder with the list of questions I ask trainees, and that was in the mid-late 70s. So a great many of them became consultant and retired quite a while back. And I've taught trainees regularly since when I became a reader. I had a lot to do with the trainees, particularly those taking final FRCA. And we had sets of tutorials, and I've done them regularly twice a year before the vivas. And I think they've enjoyed that, and I've enjoyed doing it, because it's a small group, maybe 6, 7, 8, and you can interact, and it's very easy. One thing I do is to teach them ECG reading. Yeah. Not really reading, I expect that they can do it, but what does it mean for us? Does that change in the electrocardiogram from normal? Does that mean something? Is there a specific risk we have to think about? Will it modify the way we anesthetize patients? And I always put them to the hard task of a patient with pulmonary hypertension. And I ask them during these tutorials, what do you have to watch particularly, which you watch in each and every patient, but in patients with pulmonary hypertension, it's very important, and it has nothing to do with the heart. It's simply, is there the prospect of a difficult intubation? Because if you cannot intubate somebody with pulmonary hypertension, they will die on you, and it won't take very long. When things go bad, they will go bad very quickly. And it's a sort of practical aspect of all the changes and valvular heart disease. What are the implications of aortic stenosis and the like. So you have a magnificent ECG of left ventricular hypertrophy. So what do you do if they have a obstructive cardiomyopathy? What do you have to avoid? So this is what they are not necessarily doing systematically, looking at ECG one after the other, but it covers a lot. I must admit that the first time I did it was at the college, still within the College of Surgeons, on transparencies. Now I can do it online. And all this business of teaching I've enjoyed immensely. Then I was elected to council. I'm proud of two things I have done. One was involuntary. After the shortened Kalman training scheme was introduced, the college stopped doing hospital visits. But it had to restart, and the training committee I was a member of decided that we would not send two members of council to see one hospital at a time. We would do a school. So it was Yorkshire. 16 hospitals. And I was fortunate to be allocated this task with Jean Lumley, who was at Hammersmith, and I'd admired since the early 70s. I thought it would be wonderful to work with her. Took a long time. We did something which I didn't know was rather novel. Because the training had been changed, quite naturally you wanted to see what the senior trainees thought of their training. And they were all saying, too short, we haven't had time to get some specialist work, and we don't regard ourselves as ready to be consultants in the way the consultants we work with have been ready when they were appointed. I came back to training committee. Jean had stood down from council, so I was the only one presenting 16 reports. The first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, when it came to the trainees, they all said, we are not ready. It's too short. When I came to the sixth, the chairman of the training committee said, yes, Pierre, I think you don't have to tell us much about what the trainees think of the situation. I think we've understood that. You've told us that 5 times. And I think because we were 2 senior people doing 16 hospitals and really going into the question of training, is it acceptable? And finding the answer for all of them was no, had an impact. And the college approached the Department of Health, and the training was lengthened by 1 year. I was very pleased with that. And the other one I was pleased with is the college had a very bad reputation for hospital visits, finding problems, and saying, we deregister your training. So we were a bit of the bête noire of hospital trust or whatever form they had. And I thought, that's not right, because I was on the trust board of John Ratcliffe. So I knew that we were regarded with a degree of suspicion that the college was really not doing a very good job and making life impossible. So again, I reported to the training committee, and that was taken on seriously. And the training committee decided, if there are significant defects that affect training or whatever, safety, we will act, but not by saying we de-recognize you from the 1st of April, but we invite a senior person of the trust to come to the college, have a chat with senior officers of the college, and have a plan of action. Because if there is a plan of action, people can start to find the funding, which is an important issue, or resources, whatever. It's not, we are going to de-recognize you in 2 months' time. No, we are going to have a plan of action. We know it may take 6 months, so be it. And it changed completely the perception of the college. It so happens that the only thing that is more clearly clinical I still do is the cardiac multidisciplinary team meeting for kidney pancreas transplant. When COVID struck, of course, there was a need to provide some teaching remotely. And Helen asked me to put some of my tutorials or lectures or whatever on the website of the regional trainees so that they could have access to
it? It was more than that, Pierre, actually. So if you remember what we did, we started off by offering them to the medical students and to our own trainees. But then we recognised that there was a worldwide need for these kind of materials. And so they were all put onto the OCSTAR website.
Yeah.
So
this has been an extraordinary amount of work done by OCSTAR. And this is really Helen's work as director to have inspired people and make them agree and do a lot of work, which has been immensely helpful.
But Pierre, and you're very kindly highlighting what we did, but it was absolutely a team effort. And you've always said you're nothing without the people around you. And it's so true. We have amazing clinical colleagues in Oxford. I still remember the first simulation we did in the maternity unit on Friday, March the 13th. We knew that it was coming, that there was going to be huge problems. It was going to be very frightening. And we were running a simulation to understand how we would bring pregnant women with COVID safely into the maternity unit, which rooms we would use, how we would separate women who didn't have COVID, how we would keep staff safe, how we would move the baby, if necessary, to the neonatal unit. So we had whole multidisciplinary teams of anaesthetists, obstetricians, midwives, neonatologists, paediatricians, neonatal nurses, everyone in that space, porters, everyone understanding what this would look like. And for me, that was a clear marker of the value of simulation as a tool. We had to pivot very rapidly to online resources for everything. And a lot of it was delivered live, but then it was recorded. And that was sudden awakening to the power of things like Teams and Zoom as tools for training. And of course, the college did the same thing. So we only lost 1 year for the cardiac symposium because the following year we were online. But Pierre was then all over the world. We had so many comments. We had messages from the Philippines and Laos and Africa saying, oh, this is great, thanks very much. But that's the kind of thing, actually, that during the pandemic, it felt like we were freed up to innovate in a way that is not happening now. It feels like we're very much back to command and control in the NHS. But during the pandemic, we were given that free rein as clinician educators to do what we could in novel ways, and we did, and it worked really well.
Just one thing I wanted to add, to be quite honest to our audience, and that is, everybody knows from what I've said at the beginning that I trained as a physician. So they may ask me the question, how did you train in anaesthesia? And the answer was more or less what we've said. I was in the department. I was known for teaching and helping. And consultants decided they would train me. So I did a variety of lists from orthopedic to eye hospital, but particularly a lot of vascular. And so though I was not trained in the usual manner, I think I held my own, certainly in vascular anesthesia. In a way, I've mystified everybody as if I was an anesthetist by becoming member of council of the college. And I think the best bit of mystification was to become civilian advisor in anesthetics to the armed forces. Really, the ultimate mystification. As I was saying earlier, when surgeons are asked how long a procedure will take, and they say 45 minutes, you and I know it will be an hour and a half. But I beat them hands down because I came to Oxford for 1 year, and 54 years later, they haven't been able to kick me out of the department.
Yeah, we're often accused of being only a technical specialty with no interest in patients. We all know that that's completely untrue. But listening to the pair of you, you've illustrated absolutely both the technical and the human side of our wonderful specialty. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for listening to Anaesthesia on Air from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. Make sure you don't miss out on the latest episodes by clicking subscribe on your favourite podcast platform. Also, if you enjoyed this episode, please make sure you give us a review. It helps others find our podcast. If there is a topic you'd like us to cover or you'd like to feature in the podcast, please email podcast@rcoa.ac.uk. And finally, if you would like to access more podcasts, as well as videos, e-learning, webinars, and our programme of events and courses, you can find them all online at rcoa.ac.uk/education. We hope to see you again soon.